This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. This is what most people come to Antalya for: beach, sun, and not much else. And that's fine. But head inland just a little and you can experience a different kind of Antalya. At Köprülü Canyon National Park, one of Türkiye's most accessible places for adventure sports and personal favorite spot of local guide Berfin Özçelik.
You can spend your whole day here. First, you should go to the canyon to do rafting. But there is so much more than that.
Yes, it's not just adrenaline that's to be found in these hills. High above the river, the pillars of Adam Rock surround the ruins of Selge, an ancient city that's been here far longer than the rafting routes.
Selge is like a gem waiting to be discovered.
So it's not exactly what you expected from a day in Antalya, but that's exactly the point. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Oh my God, please don't tell me he's dead. Please don't tell me my boyfriend just went like that.
There have been more than 750 fatal police shootings in America this year. You may have heard about this one.
Keep your hands where they are, please.
Yes, I will, sir. I'll keep my hands where they are. Please don't tell me this, Lord. Please, Jesus, don't tell me that he's gone. Please, officer, don't tell me that you just did this to him.
In July, Philando Castile was pulled over by police in Minnesota. He was shot, and his girlfriend filmed his death on her mobile phone. A disproportionate number of those killed by police in the United States are black. And Black Lives Matter has become a rallying cry online and of protesters on streets throughout America. But Black Lives Matter also has a British accent. It has set up in Birmingham, Nottingham, Manchester and London. Last month, a group of white Black Lives Matter protesters forced City Airport to close. But what does Black Lives Matter stand for in the UK? Do their arguments stack up? And what do they want? Join me in the briefing room to find out. With me are BBC journalist Dotun Adebayo, Kiri Kankwendi, political columnist for Media Diversified, and the special correspondent at The New Statesman, Stephen Bush. Just in case you're wondering, all three are black. And also here is Ruth Alexander from More or Less, who will fact-check some of the Black Lives Matter UK's claims. We're going to be hearing from all of them later. But first, Dotun, if you wouldn't mind, could you introduce yourself to the listeners, and who are you and how did you come to be interested in Black Lives Matter?
Well, I present a programme on BBC Five Live, Up All Night. I grew up in a Broadwater farm in Tottenham at a time when black lives didn't seem to matter. And when I heard about black lives mattering in a US context, I wasn't surprised by that. But when it came over here in the UK, it took me absolutely by surprise. I didn't know where it came from. And I decided to go and investigate a little more. I've been talking to some of the people involved in Black Lives Matter here in the UK. Have a listen.
In all honesty, I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, I'd never attended a protest before. I messaged a couple friends on the Thursday morning. The protest took place on Sunday, and people kind of shrugged it off like, oh, Caprice, like, here she goes again.
And when did you know that the protest that you had imagined had gotten out of control, if you like?
I think it was the evening of the Thursday that I made the Facebook event, because there was about over 400 retweets. And I was like, oh no, I've never been to a protest. Like, what do I say to everybody? And it actually turned out 3,000 people came, which is insane. It's amazing.
19-year-old Caprice Willow-Turner never imagined that her DIY demo that roadblocked London's Oxford Street would be seen by the media as launching a British version of a movement from the United States. To her surprise, her face was splashed across the morning papers as one of the leaders of that movement in this country. At the time, she was preparing for her first term as an undergraduate at Goldsmiths University in London, but felt she had to publicly respond to the spate of killings of black men by police in the United States. She linked her protest to the hashtag Black Lives Matter.
The power, the energy, I can feel it, like just standing here right now. Let me ask somebody, what does it mean to you to be black?
It means everything.
The 3,000 people that turned up were mostly black people from London, quite a young generation. I think their reasons for coming along was just to show that they care and they want people to start taking this matter seriously, because race in the UK is a serious matter that needs to be addressed.
How would you describe yourself, though, ethnically, racially?
I would describe myself as a mixed-race British young lady. Both my granddads are white English, born here, and they went over to Zimbabwe back in the day. And, yeah, both my grandmothers are black Zimbabwean.
You talk of the movement as if you're part of it. Do you feel that you're part of it?
I feel that I am part of it. I feel that if you believe that something is wrong and you're willing to voice that it's wrong, then you're part of a way of thinking.
Since her ad hoc protest in July, there have been a plethora of demos right across the country under the banner of Black Lives Matter, which have left huge segments of the public none the wiser of what it's all about and why we need such protest in Britain. Race relations here bear no comparison with the regularity of police killings of black men stateside. The organisational driving force of the movement in this country comprises of a semi-formal committee of people, one of whom is Kojo Kirewa.
Well, Black Lives Matter UK is a coalition of groups and individuals. I'm a member of the London Campaign Against Police and State Violence. We came together particularly after Brexit, after there was a sharp spike in racist attacks, to really force a discussion in Britain about structural racism, the legacies of colonialism and how it affects us today. Many of us are in contact with the founders of the US movement.
What do you mean by structural racism?
The popular conception of racism is like misspeaking, just being prejudiced simply on someone's skin colour as an individual act. Structural racism is actually systems of racism.
1,562 deaths in police custody in my lifetime. Zero convictions.
Black people are up to 37 times more likely to be stopped and searched.
More likely to be arrested, more likely to be convicted.
Black people face far more severe sentencing than white people for the same offence.
This is a crisis.
All black lives matter.
The outcomes and the statistics that I could reel off about deaths in custody, about stop and search, about housing, about employment, where young people, young black people, are twice more likely to be unemployed than their white counterparts. The idea that we live in a post-racial society is a pure myth.
This is a crisis.
To be a black woman in 2016 means that you're almost three times more likely to be unemployed than a white woman.
To be a black child in this country means you're three times more likely to be permanently excluded from school.
This is a crisis.
Unemployment, stop and search, structural racism. In America, Black Lives Matter's message is straightforward: stop killing African Americans. In Britain, Black Lives Matter embraces so many campaigns that it's not always clear what they have to do with stop the killings. The confusion came to a head with their two most notable demonstrations at Heathrow and London City airports, where they blocked a major road and a runway. What did that have to do with Black Lives Mattering?
The message regarding that was climate change and colonialism. How climate change, according to the UN, will affect African people and the African continent more severely than any other continent.
Yeah, so if you're protesting about climate change in Africa, how does that really resonate with your protest over here, which is about Black Lives Mattering here in Britain?
We actually wanted to talk about environmental racism. So the policies and the structural outcomes that mean black people are worse affected than white people, not just in the African continent, but even here in London. the detail is regarding where black people live. The areas they live in tend to be more polluted. And this is not an accident. It is the result of housing policies.
It wasn't just the focus of their protest which got media attention, though. In the days after the London City runway was closed down, it emerged that all nine protesters were in fact white.
White people can work in solidarity with us, but in terms of our own internal struggle, our own organisation and leadership, there is no place for white people to lead. That's not something that's negotiable for us.
For my generation, the Black Lives Matter protest echoes similar themes to the movements of the past, but their strategies are different. The anger, bitterness and outrage of my generation of black British protesters is less apparent with this new movement. Perhaps there's less for them to be angry, bitter and outraged about. Maybe because many of the bread and butter issues of race have been fought on their behalf even before they were born.
I came into this game because of personal experience. Because what happened to me and those around me. It appears to me that the young people or those who are involved at the moment are not here because of personal experience. They're here because of social media. They're here because of the things that they see happening in America.
Safir Scott is one of those old school activists from the 80s who has never given up the fight. The new generation of activists, he suspects, have enjoyed a relatively privileged existence, a far cry from the days of his own youth in Tottenham, North London. And he's sceptical about what they might achieve.
In terms of the movement, what I'd say is there a movement?
Well, something's going on that wasn't going on before. There's been a symbolism around it, of course there has, but there has been a mass support for it as well. Could you call that a movement? Why not?
Because for me, a movement has to have direction and focus. And at the moment, I fail to see it, to be totally honest with you. Best will in the world, I fail to see it.
Are you not seeing a frustration, maybe, that our generation didn't achieve the goal of making this country a fairer place for them?
Somebody said that to me once, and this is why I said to them, OK, we didn't achieve, we didn't do anything. Let me ask you, when you're going to your flash university, when you're on your way, first of all, it was our struggle that opened up universities for you. When you're on your way to university, does the bus conductor call you a black bastard and kick you off the bus? Does the tutor and lecturer look at you and call you a coon? No, they don't. That's because of us. That's because we make them know that there's a price to pay for that kind of behaviour. And what they should be coming and doing is building on that.
The times, they are a-changing. And this third or even fourth or fifth generation of post-war black Britons don't necessarily view the struggle in the way that Stafford or I or any black person that grew up in the bad old days of racism does. If a young black person like Kojo, educated, articulate, committed, wants to change things in 2016, why not become a politician?
I'm not against people participating in the electoral system. I personally don't think it's appropriate for me to do that. I have no desire to go into that. I believe change happens when movements are built, when collectives demand justice. The real issue is, do we have a movement strong enough to force any government to bring about the outcomes that we seek?
And do you have a movement that's strong enough to affect change in the way that you'd like to see it?
I wouldn't say we're there yet. The contradictions that we're seeing in society at the moment bring about opportunities or situations where people are more focused on the problems that are at hand. Our job is to organise and be ready for when the next opportunity arises and try and create those opportunities as well.
Dutton Adebayo, thank you for that report. Now, we heard a number of claims made about questions such as deaths in custody. These things easily become the stuff of mythology. So we asked Ruth Alexander of Radio 4's More or Less to sort out the stats for us. Ruth, where do you want to start with this?
Well, I'll start with the first one we heard. 1,562 deaths in police custody. That figure looks like a statistic from the charity Inquest. Their figure is the total number of people who've died following contact with the police in England and Wales since 1990, about the last 26 years. And it's not just police custody, though. It's in pursuit, in road traffic incidents, in shootings, just when they've come into contact with police. And crucially, it's the total for all people, so not just black people. You know, the implication is that black people are more likely to die in police custody. So is that true? Now, it's quite useful to actually look at the Independent Police Complaints Commission data, because that breaks figures down further in terms of ethnicity. In the past 12 years, we can see from that that 6% of the people who died in police custody over that time were black, whereas only about 4% of the general population of England and Wales is black, and 22% of the people fatally shot by police were black. But we do need to be a little bit cautious about these figures, though, because we're talking about quite small numbers. 14 black people have died in custody over that time. 6 have died after being shot by police. And although, of course, every single one of those deaths is a personal tragedy, statistically, the overall numbers aren't big enough to really tell us exactly what's going on. It could be quite complex.
So it's not suggestive here of what we think we've seen in America?
No, no. Also, the piece you were playing, people were talking about the stop and search figures. You know, there's a claim that black people are up to 37 times more likely to be stopped and searched. That's a figure from 2010-11 from the Equality and Human Rights Commission. And it actually applies to a very specific type of stop and search known as the Section 60. That's when police don't require any suspicion of wrongdoing. But if you look at government figures for all types of this sort of police activity for the last year, so more recent figures as well, it does show that black people are more likely to be stopped and searched, 4 times more likely, in fact, than white
people. That's a lot more likely.
Yeah. And are they more likely to be arrested, more likely to be convicted? That was another claim we heard. Arrested, yes. In 2014, 56 black people per 1,000 population arrested. That compares to 19 white people per 1,000 population.
So well over double.
Yes. Overall rates of prosecution and sentencing are higher too. But in terms of convictions, actually white offenders have the highest conviction rate for indictable offences. Sentencing is very interesting. It's been claimed that black people face more severe sentencing than white people for the same offence. For the same offence, that isn't something that official data tracks. It's probably very difficult to track that. But it does show that black people on average are given longer sentences than white people. But that could be down to different crime patterns. But certainly, black and ethnic minority people are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. And there is actually a government review underway at the moment into why that's the case. That's going to report in the spring.
That's crime. And you have one or two thoughts, don't you, about the treatment of black people in
more widely? Yeah, the one statistic that jumped out was about unemployment. I could hear a woman saying that to be a black woman in 2016 means that you're almost 3 times more likely to be unemployed than a white woman. Well, this is a statistic for 2011 from the Runnymede Trust, a race equality think tank. The number's slightly lower now, according to a House of Commons briefing paper published this spring, but still high though. It says that you're 2.5 times more likely to be unemployed. The unemployment rate for black women is 11.5% compared to 4.5% for white women, and it's a similar picture for men as well.
Now, sometimes what these figures fail to pick up is differences between different groups of black people and so on. And the other thing it might be failing to pick up is what you might call a class element in this.
That's right, there could be so much other stuff going on beneath these numbers. I think the numbers themselves don't tell you everything. It's likely to be very complex what's going on. It's interesting looking at education. Somebody said to be a black child in this country means you're more than 3 times more likely to be permanently excluded from school. That's true of black Caribbean pupils, if you look at government data for England. Black African pupils have lower rates of permanent exclusion, though, compared to the overall school population, and it's lower than white students.
Ruth Alexander, thank you very much indeed. Well, that's the background, and those are some of the facts, but what does it all mean, and where might it all go? Sitting there patiently with me have been Stephen Bush from The New Statesman and Kiri Kankwendi from Media Diversified, and Dotun Adebayo still with us. Kiri, can I come to you first and ask why you think this Black Lives Matter thing has happened now, at this moment in Britain?
I think there's multiple reasons for it. Obviously, looking at America, and I hate to use a cliche, but looking at social media and the way that that has, I think, brought us all closer globally. So what happens in America is immediately broadcast around the world and everyone's watching. But I also think that at a time when people are perhaps engaging less with political parties, young people are more inclined to get involved in political movements. And the Black Lives Matter movement has incredible resonance for young people living here who aren't experiencing exactly that, but are experiencing something, and it gives them the language to talk about it. It's interesting that the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement in the US and here are both young women. and the figures that Ruth brought up about employment, I think there's a lot more economically that's happening in the younger generation, which has given rise to this moment when something like Black Lives Matter just has that resonance.
I'm not clear from what you said whether it is as the result of direct experience or not.
I don't think it's direct experience in the same way that it is in America. You know, if you meet a policeman here, you're not likely to be killed in the same way that you are in America. But certainly the experience of racism is alive and well. It's not even about post-Brexit racism per se, but I've experienced racist abuse in this country. It's not like it's gone away. It's perhaps more visible now, but certainly it's still a problem. I think there is a felt experience, but it's different in nature to the US, which is why I am sometimes hesitant about bringing those frames of reference from the States over here wholesale, because I don't think it shines a light on our particular experience and historical context with colonialism and, you know, race from a very British perspective.
Stephen Bush, I was very struck by something that you wrote not long after the referendum, which was an experience of going to the town of Harlow in Essex. And it seemed to suggest that some aspects of the personal experience that we might have thought had gone were very much present.
People have used racist language to me before the 23rd of June, but there clearly has been a reawakening almost. Some of the language has been quite retro almost. I've been called a packy, slightly oddly, before the referendum, but coloured is a word that I had just only read in a book. And after the referendum, it started appearing in my inbox occasionally when I'd go on the BBC to talk about something. And it was one of the things said to me when I was in Harlow. And I think there has been an almost telling of, yes, a small group, but a significant group, that it's all right to express themselves in a way that than the generation before us had kind of pushed back against.
But the point being that actually there was something there in the first place. It wasn't. It just might have taken something to create it. But before that, you hadn't been living your life in the kind of constant expectation of discrimination or abuse, or had you?
My feeling is that you have these moments where you kind of think, oh, was there something a bit odd about that? Was the reason why, you know, when you walk into a shop and someone moves the kind of weird little, you know, the impulse buys closer to them, was that them cleaning the top or something? And that's kind of been, I think, why Black Lives Matter has appealed to a lot of people of my generation. One, because we're so aware of the States because of its, you know, its hegemonic impact on culture, global affairs, etc., etc. But it kind of is an explicit and obvious example of something that we've been able to see in the corner of our vision. And we've gone, oh, this is obviously more serious, but it's in a continuum.
The thing with racism at the moment is that it's very slippery. It's hard to pin down. It's not perhaps as overt as it was in the past. I almost feel like Black Lives Matter is a great start, but we need to broaden the conversation to talk about outcomes. Black outcomes matter. And
but I think what does that actually mean, Kerry?
Being paid less than your white counterparts. Economics. I can't stress that enough, that whether it's unemployment, whether it's underemployment, basically everything that's happening to young people now, black kids are at the sharp end of it. So youth unemployment is high, but among that, black people are particularly affected. For instance, in mental health, we know that mental health provision in this country is in a parlous state, but black people are also more likely to be detained. And I think crucially, and I think this is what also happens with the police brutality things, is that black people are more likely to be met with a stronger institutional response. Not necessarily a violent one, but, you know, instead of meeting a nurse at first, you met with the police, seen as dangerous, that sort of thing. I think these are slippery experiences that it's hard to get a handle on, and Black Lives Matter has given the language to speak about it.
One of the things which tends to happen when you get into this kind of area of identity politics is that people begin to want to get keen about definitions and so on. Is blackness, in that sense, a monolithic identity? Stephen?
It sort of depends on the context. At school, I would never have thought of myself as being black. I was mixed race, and it was always made very clear, not in an aggressive or unpleasant way, but by the actually black children, that blackness was a kingdom to which us mixed race kids could only gain a partial entry. Then I went to university and I suddenly became significantly blacker. Now I work in the parliamentary lobby and I feel incredibly black. And so it's sort of relative.
I think you have to distinguish between political blackness. I mean, I am of both African and Caribbean heritage. My mother's from Jamaica. My father's from Malawi. And it's interesting. Some people say, oh, you identify as very African. I get that from a lot of Jamaicans. But then when you come to political blackness, I think that can be quite unifying, because regardless of where you are from in the diaspora, and I think that's where Black Lives Matter falls into it, you can ascribe to those politics. And I do think that it is important to state that, you know, Britain is distinctive.
We're talking here about a black population that's actually changed quite significantly here in Britain. Ruth Alexander, what can we say about that?
Well, I've been having a look at the most recent census for England and Wales, and it shows that black Africans are now the majority group. It used to be people who identified as black Caribbean. 10 years ago, it wasn't the case that black Africans were the majority. Now it is. Their numbers have doubled from around 0.8% of the population to 1.7%. That's basically from around 500,000 people to almost a million. The number of black Caribbean people, that's stabilised at around 1.1%. There's also been an increase in those who identify as black other. That total population is just short of 300,000. And another increase has been seen among people who identify as mixed or form multiple ethnic groups. They make up 2.2% of the population.
Dr. Arabaya, do you have a sense that the black communities have changed significantly in the last few years?
Oh, it's tangible. From the days when I worked on the Voice newspaper, where the Caribbean experience was the dominant experience, of course, Caribbean people have stopped coming to Britain since the 70s or 80s because Britain made it so hard. However, there's one statistic that isn't mentioned, with all due respect, Ruth, is that the majority of us, including myself, and I've been here 51 years exactly on September the 19th, regard ourselves as black Britons.
So let's talk a little bit more about Black Lives Matter itself as an organisation. I think you've all very coherently made the case as to why there would be work to do and things to be said and things to be felt and so on. What's not at all clear to me is whether or not this is an organisation that actually has the capacity to do that. I was very struck by the argument over climate change.
Well, as you heard in Stafford Scott's response to a lot of the Black Lives Matter, they're not in touch with the community. Otherwise, they would know the environmental issues may be of generic importance, but they're not of specific importance. They're certainly not the a priori importance that Black Lives Mattering have, and I think that they've missed a chance there because they went sideways almost, whereas they need to focus on something if they're to be supported by the grassroots of the community. At the moment, there is a widespread support for them. I'm surprised, actually. Teenagers, 20-year-olds who 4 or 5 years ago we were throwing up both our arms and wondering what's happened to them. They are politically engaged. Many of them are talking about Black Lives Matter, but I don't think they get the idea of going off and protesting about the environment.
We know that climate change affects people in the global south more, but it feels a bit like starting a conversation about the employment rights of women by going, if you're a duke's daughter, you won't inherit. It's true, but it's not really core to the big issue, and it turns a lot of people off from the get-go. And it's very important for new movements in particular to pick issues they can win, because winning tends to build more wins.
Yeah. Kiri?
I think what I would like to see is more movements. Black Lives Matter, yes, it probably needs to narrow it down and pick one, but I think it can't be on them to do everything, a bit like how you get one young woman that does amazing and then suddenly all feminists hope rides on her. If people feel strongly about other issues, bring those forward. I mean, it's a young movement. It clearly, you know, there's flaws, but it doesn't preclude other people coming up and taking the mantle for other issues.
So you think it's got a future?
Yes, I do.
You
paused. I thought there's a youthful enthusiasm there, and that sort of resonance that Dotton mentioned about lots of young people understanding it. I just think that we need to deepen the conversation, because I think also we live in an age where I suppose the more dramatic is what kind of grabs everyone's attention. But as Ruth mentioned with the figures, a lot of the big struggles are actually more mundane, more everyday, not as interesting, but equally more important and affect more people, like employment.
So what can we conclude about this? I think from the discussion, we can say that Black Lives Matter does represent something. It represents a movement of younger generation black people, even if it was sparked by what had been happening in the United States. And our guests consider there's a future for it, but maybe if they zero in a bit more on their core demands. Well, my thanks to those guests, Stephen Bush, Dotton Adebayo, Kiri Kankwendi and Ruth Alexander. Next week on The Briefing Room, well, who knows?
Thanks for listening to this week's edition of The Briefing Room on Black Lives Matter in the UK. It was presented by David Aronovich, produced by Joe Kent and me, Alex Burton. It was mixed by Neil Churchill and our editor is Innes Bowen. If you like the programme, if you want to tell us what you thought of it, the best way to do that is to comment on iTunes or whatever podcast subscriber you use. Or alternatively, you can email us. We are thebriefingroom@bbc.co.uk. See you next week.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.